1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. We would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We certainly hope you all enjoy the show. And remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there's still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody. Everybody.
Everybody needs somebody.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we do double features and commentary tracks. And this is our double feature on the Blues Brothers and Blues Brothers 2000. One is really undeservedly well-remembered, and the other is deservedly kind of forgotten. I actually, mentioned Blues Brothers 2000 to my mom, who, loves the first one and whatever. She didn't even know it existed, so it goes to show you how much of an impact that made. But we will go through it chronologically. Okay, so Blues Brothers. We really do a lot of John Landis, don't we, on this podcast?
Unintentionally, it seems
Yeah, we've done Twilight Zone, the movie. We've done American Werewolf. And, these were both by John Landis. He probably should have known better than to do the second one, but I guess we'll get to that. In 1980, he was, flying real high, had just done Animal House, which is like the biggest grossing comedy ever at that time. And John Belushi was in that, and he's this huge star. And like the first 5 years of Saturday Night Live are over, and, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and the rest of them are all kind of branching out and breaking into movies. I mean, Blues Brothers isn't. Actually, even Animal House. Well, no, I think Animal House might have been the first major movie to have SNL alumni in it. Well, actually, they were still doing SNL at the time. And then Meatballs in 79 was like Bill Murray's first starring role, and I think he might have just left SNL in the fourth year. So this would have been the first time that you had SNL actors in a major movie after leaving the show. But not only that, it is the first movie based on SNL characters, which I think is a tradition that we would have been better off without.
Yeah.
and like I said, this movie's got a good reputation, but boy was it disappointing to find out how mediocre at best this movie is, considering the reputation that it's had around it over the years.
Have you seen it before?
I had seen parts of it many times over the years because, throughout the entire decade of the 90s, I think they played it on, TBS and TNT, every single week. So I'd definitely seen, the scene at the nunnery with Kathleen Freeman. But actually, more than anything, I just remember changing the channel to it in the last 10 minutes or so of the big epic car chase. And that was just kind of my impression of it. And if that's all you've got to go off of for your impression of the Blues Brothers, like me, you probably thought it was a better movie than it was, because you're like, wow, look at this crazy elaborate car chase. I bet the rest of the movie is also really fun.
And then you learn that Dan Aykroyd cannot do a Chicago accent. So I saw it I'd heard about it for years, that the Blues Brothers great, blah, blah, blah. John Landis. I think in the 90s, John Landis sort of was... He was one of those guys that everybody agreed his best years were behind him, type thing. But no, he made some really great movies, right? Like he made Animal House, and he made this, and he made American Werewolf in London. And what I always find amusing now is that nobody ever was like, he made Into the Night, which I think is easily his best movie, the sort of After Hours knockoff with Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer. But it opens with these city shots of the south side of Chicago. They're really gradual. It's beautiful. I mean, it's this really exquisite, carefully edited, beautifully photographed sequence. You know, the sun's coming up. I find the waiting... So it opens with John Belushi getting out of jail and Dan Aykroyd picking him up. It's mildly obnoxious after you've seen the movie because it plays into their egos. I mean, the egos in this movie are just sort of incredible.
are really off the chain. Like, you're right, because the whole sequence of John Belushi getting out of jail is as if we're watching, like, Max Cady get out of jail.
Yeah,
it's like, he's just like this short, kind of squat, stocky guy, you know? Like, and then eventually you find, like, not too long after that, you find out that he was in jail for however long for, like, robbing a gas station, so...
To pay the band!
To pay the band. So, but they gave him this big setup like he's this hardened criminal because, you know, John Belushi felt really cool doing a scene where he's being let out of jail for what I guess we're supposed to presume are crimes against humanity until we find out what it is.
And I mean, I grew up in the Chicago area, so people lionizing John Belushi and the Blues Brothers, it's sort of understandable, right? Because there really are only 10 movies that anybody knows about that were shot in Chicago. And only three of those are, you know, freaking John Hughes movies, but he shot all of them there. So, you know, people really hyped it up. You know, it was really hyped up. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, John Belushi's not a very good actor in this. he's better than Dan Aykroyd, but that's like saying that, I mean, I didn't think Dan Aykroyd could get worse than he was in the Blues Brothers, but we'll talk about that in about 25 minutes.
and you know, Daniel Clowes, the comics author who created Ghost World, he has a story that's reprinted in the collection 20th Century 8-Ball, which is all about Chicago because he grew up there, and He's trying to, like, analyze the mystique of Chicago, and he mentions the Blues Brothers at one point as, like, being sort of the crystallization of when Chicagoans started getting really self-conscious about Chicago and establishing it as, like, you know, a city with a reputation in its own right, you know, aside from New York and L.A. being, like, you know, the big city, the big city of the Midwest, and trying to kind of like reclaim an identity that had faded away since, you know, the gangster days, essentially. And Blues Brothers was like this big, you know, keystone of that. And that kind of helps you understand the popularity of the movie more. But speaking of the popularity of the movie in Chicago, well, I mean, Klaus is basically making fun of that because he's saying the Blues Brothers also made it like okay for white guys to pretend to be these jazz Negroes, and those are those are my words, not his. But more than being an important keystone in the, you know, the new aesthetic of Chicago, the Blues Brothers was a keystone in the history of white people appropriating black people's culture, because, you know, okay, that's been going on since at least Elvis, but with the Blues Brothers, it was kind of this thing of like John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and John Landis are going to make this music cool again.
Yeah.
By making a movie about it.
And they're going to bring it to the white audiences or something. And you could tell that they really felt like they were doing something like that, that they were really like bringing James Brown to Whitey. And you're just kind of like, it's James Brown. He's been around for,
I know, it's not like, it's not like in 1979, white people hadn't heard of Aretha Franklin, you know, but they do have this attitude with all these cameos that like, hey, America, you know, look, the blues and soul and like incredibly pretentiously assuming that this kind of music like had no way of reaching white audiences unless it were in a John Landis movie. It's just uncomfortable to watch people pretend to be something that they're not. And, you know, I'm talking about anything here, not just, you know, white people playing blues music. It's uncomfortable to watch people pretend to be something that they're not, and that's like – that's why these characters are so inane, is that, like, they don't have personalities. Basically, they've just got the look of the black suits and the Chicago accents. And then every once in a while, they do a bad rendition of a blues standard. And I don't know. I guess in the late 70s, or people were just eating that stuff up.
Well, I mean, especially if you go off the Blues Brothers.
You mentioned to me before we recorded that, like, wasn't the Blues Brothers album, which was released before the movie, it was based on their appearances on Saturday Night Live. I should mention that they would, like, show up as a joke opening act for, like, whoever the real musical guest was that week. But, like, their tie-in album, Briefcase Full of Blues, was, like, one of the best. Is still one of the best-selling blues albums ever.
And, I mean, regardless of the actual band being technically good, John Belushi can sing all right. Dan Aykroyd can't. So Dan Aykroyd, like, apes around on stage. He primps a little. And it's embarrassing. It embarrasses you to be watching it. but what I wanted to say was a couple things. One is, if John Landis actually respected what he was doing and wasn't doing it just to show off how great he was, I was reading that Cab Calloway wanted to do, like, a disco version of his number to make it modern, and John Landis wouldn't let him do it. So he was basically telling the artist
yeah.
that he couldn't do that. And the other thing is, and I'll get on this on the second one. It ends with them playing to 5,000 people after a really stupid sequence of them hyping it. And they're all white people. They're
yeah,
all these little white
yeah.
kids.
I noticed that too. And
yeah.
I also noticed that at the end of Blues Brothers 2000, that the big concert that the movie ends with is in front of a 90% to 95% white audience.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, the band, I mean, they actually, you know, and they kind of make a big deal out of this in the movie, because the first half or whatever is them having to drive around and reassemble the band. Like, they plucked together this group of, you know, real musicians like Donald Duck Dunn. And but that's just not good enough. I mean, I guess the other thing that really doesn't work is that I guess – Aykroyd and Belushi, the concept of the Blues Brothers, like, worked as an act on Saturday Night Live, because it's just the two of them on stage, and it's not like they're great singers, but you can see them. But, you know, they're physical performers; they're comedians.
Right.
They can add that element. I think there is like barely even a scene in the whole movie where you watch Aykroyd and Belushi do their thing physically on stage. I think probably the longest stretch of them performing in the movie is when they're at the Redneck Bar. And then even then, like, the joke is that they're constrained behind chicken wire and they can't really, like, get into it physically. And then, okay, yeah, you see them dancing on the stage at the big concert at the end of the movie, but, like, they're also cutting away to, like, two or three other things that are happening. So, like, even the tiny bit of their act that could have worked in the movie, Landis doesn't even do, because he's got, like, a zillion other guest stars who have real musical talent. Oh, and speaking of which, Landis doesn't know how to shoot a musical performance. Or
no.
Music. I mean, okay, he's competent at it, but I really hated how, like, abruptly the songs from the cameos in the movie
yeah.
stopped and started. Like, when Aretha Franklin starts singing Think, it just comes out of nowhere, and then it ends out of nowhere. And, you know, in a musical, like, things are supposed to – like, the mood is supposed to build up towards the moment when people spontaneously break out into song, because people – in real life, people don't just spontaneously break out into song. You need to kind of, like, build to that mood and establish the fantasy of it. In Blues Brothers, Aretha Franklin just, like, starts singing.
Yeah, that's really bad, that one. And I feel like that's more her fault.
Okay.
Well, I mean, she can't stop. She's, like, laughing She's smiling through the whole performance. It's stupid.
Yeah, that's true.
James Brown does a little bit better. Ray Charles is a little bit better. I think James Brown is still probably the best one. But you mentioned the redneck bar, and that's the other thing about this movie is it's also about how lame white people are.
Oh yeah, no, that's like the whole joke of the redneck bar scene, and it's really uncomfortable. Like, oh, we got both kinds of music, country and western. Like, haha, yeah, white people are so lame.
Yeah, not, I mean,
not
it's
like, not like the cool white people who want to be black.
Right, and it's just, and then there are the neo Nazis with Henry Gibson.
Yeah, how weird is that? I mean, that's. Okay, yeah, there's a historical context to it in that, like,
right, because of
making
Skokie,
fun of
the
court decision from Skokie, Illinois, and that's the joke of I hate Illinois Nazis. But, like, what does that have to do with the blues again? Right?
I mean, the movie's – what was it? It's 130 minutes, and we didn't even watch the longest version.
It's ridiculously overlong.
Universal made them cut out another 18 minutes or something, and they've re-released that. But thank God the Blu-ray plays with the theatrical cut, so you don't have to sit through even more of this movie.
I think it was in the IMDb trivia that they say that, like, Dan Aykroyd wrote like a 500-page treatment, and then John Landis just, like, went into it with a chainsaw and cut it down to – to 120 something pages, but it you can tell. You can tell because, like, there's no natural connective tissue or segues between any scenes. Like, I guess you could make that criticism of a lot of John Landis movies, but, like, yeah, there's very little connection from one scene to another. Things just kind of start and stop, herky jerky all the way through.
I'm trying to remember I can't remember when I read this, but it was in the last 3 weeks, so it might have been about Ghostbusters 3, which Dan Aykroyd's currently trying to put together yet again. And it said that Dan Aykroyd's scripts are the worst thing you've ever read in your life, and then somebody else gets a hold of them and you have a movie. And it scares me, the idea of how much worse this would have been in Dan Aykroyd's universe.
Well, you know, if you... Dan Aykroyd should not have creative control over anything he does. And in a way, John Landis shouldn't either. I mean, that's the other thing that this movie got me thinking about is how, like, anything good that John Landis has directed was not written by him, with the exception of An American Werewolf in London, which he wrote, like, as a teenager, supposedly. But, like, Animal House was not written by him. The Kentucky Fried Movie was not written by him. That was the Zucker Brothers. But, yeah, this, like, Landis... I remember years ago as a little kid, like, mentioning the Blues Brothers to my dad, and my dad said, like, that the Blues Brothers was proof that John Landis couldn't direct. And as a little kid, I didn't know what he was talking about. But now that I'm grown up, I completely agree with you, Dad, yeah.
Okay, other things to point out that really, really suck.
Well, you know what's silly is, like, you know, how the Illinois Nazis have nothing to do with the blues. Neither do car chases. and a full quarter of this movie is car chases. And it's basically like John Landis admitting to the audience that, like, hey, these characters and this concept are not enough to pad out a whole movie, so here's some car chases. And, you know, I'll only, you know, Landis's reliance on explosions and car chases, I think we all know where that led.
Oh, I was going to wait till the next one to mention that he killed Vic Morrow, that he killed Jennifer Jason Leigh's dad.
Well, I don't think you can ever mention that too
no.
much.
No, so I'll bring it up again in about 15 minutes. But no, yeah. The big car chase through the mall, which everybody loves and everybody talks about, I don't like it because he has no establishing shots of the geography of the mall, so it's not exciting to me. It's not realistic. It's not like they actually... did this. It's not, you know, Bullet. It's not the French Connection. It's
right.
This artificial it's a bunch of sight gags that aren't very funny, and it'd be funnier if you actually had to go through the mall and know where the stores were. And this is after Dawn of the Dead. Now, I do want to talk
I was thinking that. I was thinking, like, the only reason this scene is in the movie is because John Landis probably saw Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, you know, you've seen Dawn of the Dead. You know that you need to have the site references refer back on each other for it to, you know, make an impact. And he doesn't have that. And the other thing is this movie is from 1980. All That Jazz came out in 1979. The musical numbers in this movie, and I say this probably not having seen a musical that I can remember after this movie, except maybe Evita, which didn't have a lot of dancing. But post All That Jazz, none of the musical numbers in this cut it anymore. I mean, they're silly. It's a bunch of, you know, they've got the, even the James Brown number that I was, you know, complimentary of. He's got these intercuts of these, you know, people twirling around. It's like, what the hell is the point of this? Actually physically being able to do this, John Landis.
Well, the purpose of that scene is to establish the theme that black people are magic.
Oh, I didn't think you were going there. I thought you were going with the whole mission from God thing, which was pretty
obnoxious.
Oh, well,
I mean, we might as well. I mean, we'll touch on that in a second. But no, it's to establish that black people are magic and can erupt into song at any moment and, you know, and can also change their clothes magically and start singing Minnie the Moocher if the situation calls for it. But yeah, no, that's – yeah, we're on a mission from God. Okay, maybe that's kind of funny once because of the Chicago accent that it's being spoken through and everything, but this movie is an exhibit in the case against American audiences as far as, like, boy, if you just repeat a mediocre line enough times, it'll become a beloved catchphrase, won't it?
Well, what I actually love is I was on YouTube looking up Blues Brothers stuff, and I noticed Epic Moments from the Blues Brothers, a video thing. I didn't watch it because I didn't have to, because it was only a minute 42. Okay? That means that they took, what does that translate to? Not 1 second from every minute of the movie, but basically...
Yeah.
And that's all they could come up with. If this is some great movie, you're saying that not even a sequence is worth.
Yeah, not even an entire sequence. I know. And look, I've been trying to think about, like, you know, why people like this movie. And I can kind of get it, but I mean, it's kind of a movie for 8-year-olds, and if you're over a certain age and you really love this movie, you need some better taste in movies because it's kind of like a kid's movie more than anything.
Well,
like only a kid really wouldn't care how little sense anything makes. But I don't
know. It's got to be a very patient kid to get through the musical numbers that are pointless. And they're like, look, we know Ray Charles and we got him to be in this movie. Isn't that funny? No.
Yeah.
No, Dan Aykroyd, it's not.
A lot of this movie is just, hey, look, it's...
Like, yeah.
Hey, look,
it's Steven Spielberg at the end.
Yeah, hey, look, it's Twiggy. Hey, look, it's Charles Napier.
One good thing I will... One of the good things about it, performance-wise, and there aren't very many good things about it performance-wise, John Candy was... good.
Oh yeah, no, I wanted to say that there's probably two funny things in the whole movie, and he's one of them. What I'm thinking of specifically is ordering 3 orange whips. and that's talent, because that's just timing. That's just orange whip, 3 orange whips. And like, and if anybody else in the world said that, it wouldn't be funny, but the way he says it, it's hilarious. The other thing that's funny, actually, is the moment in the redneck bar sequence when they play Stand By Your Man and Landis cuts to the crying rednecks. And granted, that is the making fun of white people thing that we mentioned, but it's pretty good making fun of white people.
It is good making fun of white people. I think the problem is that it really has no in-between. So he makes fun of neo-Nazis. He makes fun of white trash, pieces of shit.
Yeah.
And then he makes fun of really rich people, but he actually makes them sympathetic because John Belushi's sitting there, you know, talking about raping the guy's kids. And it's just like, wow, that's not really that cool. It's sort of disgusting, actually.
That was the moment. Well, that was the moment when I realized that, like, Jake and Lloyd, right? No, Jake and Elwood Blues. I guess I was mixing it up with Jake Lloyd in my head. There's no characters behind that because, like, if you imagine the Three Stooges in a restaurant full of snooty rich people and they're disturbing the rich people, like, you know, you know that they're gonna do some funny stuff. Jake and Elwood Blues, like, it really falls flat when you put them in that cliched kind of situation, which should be funny,
right?
If they had any kind of character whatsoever, but because they don't, like, the way that Aykroyd and Landis and Belushi play it is just to have them be incredibly obnoxious. And speaking of the Three Stooges, the whole we've got to get money to save the orphanage plot is straight out of the Three Stooges. But I wish, you know, they had acknowledged at some point how silly that is or how cliched it is. I don't even know if Landis realized how corny that was. I don't know. It's really hard to tell where this movie's coming from, and it's even harder to try to analyze it through the filter of the hype. The hype that resides with us to this day, even.
I mean, it's sort of stunning that this movie... So we've had... John Belushi's been dead now 30 years,
Yeah,
right?
30 years. Yeah.
30 years. We've seen Chris Farley get remembered as a comedy genius from Chicago when the truth is, no, he was an obnoxious fat guy who wasn't funny, and B, wasn't even, you know, an iota of a good actor that John Belushi occasionally was. And he didn't want to be. He wanted to be a fat, drunk guy. So we've gone through that, right? We thanks to David Spade, he's really turned him into that. And I think that is interesting that this movie's not produced by Lorne Michaels, who produces all of the Saturday Night Live stuff to this day. And for the period where things were popular, he was really the one who pushed these images of that we should be in awe of the comic genius of these guys. When the truth is that Lorne Michaels didn't produce any of John Belushi's movies, I don't think. He didn't produce any of Dan Aykroyd's, and if he's producing Chevy Chase's now, it's because Lorne Michaels' career is in a bad place. I there's an anecdote, I can't remember who told it to me, about Lorne Michaels being so desperate for female writers on Saturday Night Live, he'd like stop people on the street if he vaguely recognized them as a female comedy writer. I assume that was before Tina Fey, because he sort of wrote her like a John Belushi. But the fact that anybody still thinks this movie has any merit whatsoever, I would give you 10 years ago. When I saw it in the theater or whatever, that was, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
You went to a screening 10 years ago?
Oh, God. I saw it at the Universal Radio City Music Hall. They might still have it, but every summer they, back around 98, 99, they had they played movie festivals, and they do one studio a year, a summer. So one summer I saw Warner Brothers stuff, one summer I saw Universal stuff, this, Animal House, Fast Times, and Jaws on the world's biggest movie screen.
Yeah.
And at that point, I guess whenever I saw that, 98, 99, maybe even 97, I can still see that people would still like this, because Belushi had only been dead 15 years then. But now we're at a quarter century. And Dan Aykroyd has gone on to make some of the worst and most unforgivable films.
I know, and you haven't even seen Nothing But Trouble yet.
Right.
You haven't even seen the bottom of the barrel.
I mean, Chevy Chase, hey, man, you know, Community's bringing him back, regardless of the fact that he doesn't do any work and he doesn't, you know, and he's not actually good and they cut his performance to be good. He's coming back, but Dan Aykroyd will never come back.
Yeah, you know, It's funny, Ghostbusters. I mean, that's I feel like that's the best movie that anybody in that movie was ever involved with, especially if they had been a part of Saturday Night Live, because somehow in Ghostbusters, like, you can kind of believe that Dan Aykroyd is pretty much playing himself and Bill Murray is pretty much playing himself. It's when Dan Aykroyd has to play anybody else, you know, like, say, a Chicago blues man, quote unquote, that things really go off the rails. By the way, I wasn't expecting to see Hieronymus Bud again so soon. from Galaxina.
Wait, was he in this?
He's the guy who offers them the contract backstage. That's
Is
how they
he?
Get the money. Yeah. Everybody's
oh,
in this
movie. Oh, I wasn't paying attention. Oh, their manager's good.
Everybody's in this movie.
Their
yeah.
manager's good.
Oh, oh yeah, yeah.
Slime. That guy's good. He's good, yeah. Is this the one where they... Yes, it is. They meet him in a... This is how bad Landis is at setting up a joke and following through, which is inexplicable. The guy has made funny movies.
Okay, right.
But there's this scene where they're meeting with their manager and he's in a sauna because we're still pre-Seinfeld, so saunas were still in movies and TV shows. And the guy, and they're talking to him and they're in their towels. And then we reveal that the entire band is there with them in their towels too. And they all get up and leave together. Landis can't make it funny. He can't even do a sight gag. I mean, it's not... It shouldn't be this hard. I don't know what it is about it that he just can't get it. It's like he put all of his creative energy into figuring out how he was going to do those. The opening titles are really strange. Like it opens with, doesn't it open with like the casting by, and then it goes through all the credits.
Yeah, it goes through
producer,
all these credits, and then, which, yeah.
And then it cuts to cast, and then it does writer and director. So, I mean, like, clearly this is pre-George Lucas throwing his DGA card down over Empire Strikes Back or whatever. So uh-huh. they still were able to play with opening credits a little bit more. But that's, like, the most creative thing in the damn movie. Well, we're getting to the end of it, but I do want to bitch a little bit about the car chase at the end.
Okay.
The scenes where they fall forever through the sky.
Oh yeah, even as a kid that bugged me. I was like, what freeway overpass is like a mile above ground level?
I mean, you're from Michigan, so you know the Skyway, right? But that wasn't the Skyway.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of like, so it's like a Roadrunner cartoon? Use the music. Use the yeah. music. If it's the Roadrunner cartoon, use
I guess,
the music.
I guess that is one of the handful of laughs in the movie. Not the falling car, but the fact that one Nazi turns to the other and says, I love
yeah,
you
that is
before
pretty
they
good.
Crash.
Yeah. Well, especially since there's the boat. It goes on a little bit too long with Henry Gibson like, am I supposed to say something?
Yeah, it's almost you get the feeling it's an ad lib, and yeah, but no, it doesn't make up for all the stuff that should be funny but isn't, like when he drops Carrie Fisher in the mud after kissing her. There's a lot to talk about in this movie. We're pretty much out of time.
Yeah,
trying to keep it timely. There's too much to talk in this movie, but that's because it's just the sum of its parts.
Moment to moment.
It's totally moment to moment. And it's totally, let's try to get a cameo in every single scene so that people are distracted from the fact that nothing is going on in this movie.
And I mean, okay, one last thing, since you brought up Carrie Fisher, who sucks, by the way. She's terrible.
Yeah.
She's looking at all these weapons manuals. And that's, like, supposed to be funny, is that she's, like, an assassin. She's not assassin. She's, like, a terrorist. Wasn't terrorism worse in a lot of ways in the 80s or late mid-70s? You had Munich. You had
the Achille Lauro.
It's not funny. It's not funny, John Landis.
She does... Her look does seem to have been somewhat inspired by Patty Hearst, now that you mention it.
Yeah.
I guess that was the joke. Oh, and that, by the way, part of the handful of funny things in the whole movie, which, by the way, my handful of funny things are not what I hear other people reference. The fact that Carrie Fisher is reading one of those Soldier of Fortune magazines inside a hair salon called Curl Up and Die, DYE, that made me chuckle.
That was funny.
The subtle humor in the Blues Brothers is better than the rest of it, and there's not a lot of subtle humor. All right, well, I guess that about does it.
We don't have a natural segue. I was really honestly gonna say that the way I wanted to start talking about the Blues Brothers 2000 was to get out a cast and credits list and just start at the top and be like, fuck John Landis, fuck Dan Aykroyd, fuck John Goodman, fuck Joe Morton, and just go through the whole thing. But, you know, I was worried that...
You can't say fuck Miles Dyson, come on. That was the first surprise, like, hey, Miles Dyson is in this. The other surprise was the realization that John Goodman was in this movie the same year as he was in The Big Lebowski.
Yes, I thought about that too.
Guy likes to work.
John Goodman likes money a lot.
Yeah, and for better or for worse, you know. How about let's start with like the first second of the movie. Okay. That opens with a card saying, for John Belushi, Cab Calloway, John Candy. Oh, and it's J-O-H-N Candy in the credits, apparently, not J-O-N, which is what he's been credited as much of the rest of his career.
He's an H. Isn't he? He's an H.
Huh?
I think he's an H.
Oh, well, whatever. Regardless, my point is, how about
let me get it over with right now. Let's get over with the Cab Calloway. Okay, it's for Cab Calloway. Now, Joe Morton, as the only black guy in the movie, because they thought they needed one in this one in the band, as opposed to Cab Calloway, who was just kind of around the band. And I think Cab Calloway had to be half white. But anyway, Joe Morton is playing Cab Calloway's illegitimate son. His character from the first movie's illegitimate son, whose nickname is Cab. Now, my problem with this throughout the movie was Joe Morton is not Cab Calloway's son. Why is Joe Morton in this movie? I appreciate that he can do the frustrated cop shtick. I appreciate, he's better at that than when he becomes a Blues Brother, because about 5 minutes after he becomes a Blues Brother, there's blackface involved. But okay, so backing up, and Paul Schrader apparently playing a drag queen, but backing
Schaefer.
Up. Schaefer. Schaefer, yeah. Sorry. Yes, Paul Schaefer is the drag queen. I can't forget about that. Why the hell did they think they needed to homage a character, a real person? The joke of the first one was that Cab Calloway was a real blues guy, right? That's why John Landis made him do
Minnie the Moocher,
the way the big band style, not letting him do what he wanted. Why homage him with Joe Morton? Why homage him with Miles Dyson?
Because they didn't have John Belushi and they were grasping at threads to connect this to the original. That's why they bring back Kathleen Freeman and the guy who plays the manager and even Frank Oz, because he's a personal friend of Landis's, comes back. He's been promoted from the job that he had in the first movie to the warden of the prison now.
And I thought that was interesting. And this is one of the things, you watch Blues Brothers 2000 and it's written by Landis and Aykroyd. Landis directed, he did a slight homage, and I want to say and slight because he does such a bad job of homaging the opening credits of Blues Brothers in Blues Brothers 2000. Like it's like a TV movie version of it. It's 20 years later, whatever, right? There's a reference to the privatization of prisons and stuff, but it's not actually about how the world's changed in the 20 years that Dan Aykroyd's been in prison. Except yeah, they throw him a little white
nothing,
boy.
Nothing really surprises Dan Aykroyd, yeah. despite the fact he's been in prison for 20
years. And he knows
years.
About cyber porn, which doesn't make any sense. But and they throw him a little they throw him a little white kid to play with, which is apparently the a precursor to Star Wars Episode One. And we can actually thank James Cameron for that, because Terminator 2 started the whole you need to give the awkward kid sidekick.
Yeah, apparently Landis conceived the role for Macaulay Culkin, which tells you how long a Blues Brothers sequel was in being prepared, even after Belushi's death.
And then James Belushi isn't in this.
Yeah, I was thinking
and we talked
about that.
About
like,
that.
How,
yeah,
how funny is it that Jim Belushi, like you know, snatched up that mantle for the live show of the Blues Brothers as soon as his brother was dead, and then by the time they get around to making another movie, he, you know, supposedly is unavailable.
Well,
shooting
I was
a
reading
sitcom,
the trivia,
but I find it kind of hard to believe that
sitcom.
He didn't want to be in this.
He apparently he was shooting Total Security, which co-starred him and James Remar. And Stephen Bochco produced it. It was one of Stephen Bochco's first things after NYPD Blue. And I remember it being really freaking good. So that's like what's funny. You can't get it, of course. But it was like a really good proto 44-minute sitcom procedural Private Eye thing. It was funny. And I mean, because basically they stuck to disconnected sitcoms together, but whatever. I mean, it was funny. And so it's like, so James Belushi was unable to do this piece of shit because he was in a sitcom that wasn't a piece of shit that I can't see again, yet Blues Brothers 2000 is probably going to be on freaking Blu-ray under the 100th anniversary Universal logo before the end of the year.
I bet they come up with a really great marketing idea, like it's the Blu-ray Brothers. Shoot me.
Yeah. Ooh, no, wait, that's actually a joke in this, because the Bluegrass Brothers, because they're still making fun of white people.
Oh, yeah, they are. And instead of the Illinois Nazis, it's the Russian Mafia for the old,
the
ex-KGB Russian Mafia is after them for some ungodly reason.
So that's
the thing, is that, I mean, you know, first of all, the movie is just a remake of the first one with none of the cameos to keep you distracted. Well, I mean, they do have cameos. It's just that they suck.
Aretha Franklin. We've gone
from
worse.
Okay. Well, they do get Aretha Franklin back, and they don't get Ray Charles back.
No.
Cab Calloway is dead.
James Brown doesn't sing in his cameo. I was waiting for James Brown to sing, and he doesn't.
Right, right.
He's sort of like backing vocals for the other guy.
Yeah.
They got Wilson Pickett, who was actually good. That was actually good. The whole phone sex thing, it sucked, but it was Wilson Pickett.
Shortly thereafter, you have Blues Traveler, who's a real relic of the 90s by now.
But if it weren't,
there's kind of an accuracy in the scene when Blues Traveler goes up to Dan Aykroyd and says, "Oh man, if it hadn't been for the Blues Brothers, I never would have gotten to blues." It's like, yeah, a lot of fat white guys never would have gotten into Chicago style blues if not for the Blues Brothers. Fuck you, Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, God. All right, so I feel like we've missed something.
Well, on the subject of cameos also, I've always been a big Daryl Hammond fan. I've always been outspoken for him as like the guy who should have gotten famous instead of Will Ferrell. But
you're going to have to shut up now, aren't you? A little bit.
Yeah. Landis, even though the Russian Mafia is already taking the place of the Illinois Nazis, Landis feels like he still needs other villainous white people. So he has Daryl Hammond show up as a Southern, South shall rise again type of separationist person. And he gets squashed by a boat, and it's funny, even though that would be a horrific death. And speaking of horrific death, there's a giant police car pileup.
Police car pileup in history. It's 60 cars. And here's the best part about it, mini rant. He doesn't fucking set it up. Landis doesn't set up that there are 60 cars pursuing them. He sets up there, maybe six, but then you cut to this idiotic shot of like 60 cars piling up. Well, where the fuck did they come from, John? I killed Vic Morrow, John Landis.
And the amazing thing, like, post Vic Morrow isn't just that, like, John Landis still loves his car crashes and explosions. It's also that he has no qualms about doing car crash or explosion scenes where in real life tons of people would be maimed or killed. That's the thing about that police car pileup is that, like, you see 80 police cars pile up, and then when they're all done piling up and, like, you know, all the metal is smashed on top of metal, like, the cops just kind of crawl out of the windows and go, oh boy, what a headache, you know, because it's in this cartoon world where nobody ever gets hurt. And that bugged me about, you know, Blues Brothers also, like the total disregard for human life that Jake and Elwood have by driving through a mall is actually the same disregard for human life that John Landis has.
Exactly. I mean, that's sort of what it is that John Landis does not have any regard for human life because John Landis has a Jesus complex. I think he really does.
He also compensates for his lack of ideas with car chases and explosions.
Hold
but...
on. I don't want to skip this because this wasn't part of the first one. So I think we should definitely touch on it that for whatever reason, Landis and Aykroyd feel like they need to exploit women in this one. Yet it's PG-13.
Oh, you mean like with the strip club scene?
Yeah, the strip club scene where it's shockingly unfunny when they're like, and from Northwestern University, it's blah, blah, blah. It would be funny if they were believable as college students, but it looks like they hired the cheapest strippers in Toronto, which is where that was filmed. And that's the best part about this movie is when you can spot when it shifts from their 2 days of shooting in Chicago to where they shot in Canada.
Yeah. There's also, you know, tying together women are scary with black people are magic is the character of like the voodoo queen or whatever who's having a battle of the bands. And that's where the big climactic music concert happens. And she just literally has magic powers. She just literally like turns them into zombies at one point so that they can sing Caribbean style music.
Turns them into blackface zombies.
Well, green face, so to speak.
Well, sure, but that's not what they meant.
Okay, no, I hear you.
Dancing.
And it's also like the actors didn't want real makeup on it. You can tell like they just changed the hue of their skin tones in the editing room, so it looks really bad.
What about when Joe Morton flies through the giant vagina?
Oh,
the sky?
Right. Okay. Well, that's probably the most racist thing in this very racist pair of movies is that Joe Morton is the cop for like 3/4 of the movie, and he's leading the chase for Elwood Blues, and then because you know, I guess they're supposed to be referencing John Belushi seeing the light in the church scene from the first movie, Joe Morton, just by listening to James Brown and the guy who's doing the majority of the singing, realizes that he's meant to be a blues brother. So he flies up into the air and in a flash of lightning, he's got the black suit. And then he comes back down to earth and starts backflipping through the church, just like John Belushi's double did backflips in the first movie. But what's most insulting about this, besides the black magic, is that in the scene afterwards, Joe Morton won't stop babbling about how it's in the blood that he's meant to be a blues brother. He's talking about like the power of the blood, and I guess that's like an old Christian hymn or whatever. But it just sounds like John Landis is saying that, you know, oh, those Negroes got music in their soul, don't they? And even a black cop can't resist the power of the music.
Yeah, and there's a scene so in between Blues Brothers and Blues Brothers 2000, you had the Cosby Show, which is when you had for a while, you had white people embracing black entertainment, but you also had the start of BET, which is, and WB and all that. So then you pulled back from that. You pulled back to having the token on one show and networks going, dude, you guys have a whole network. Who cares if Eric LaSalle's the only black guy on TV?
Yeah, and it's what happened between Blues Brothers and Blues Brothers 2000 as far as like the acceptance of blacks in mainstream entertainment is complicated, but you're right. I mean, there was a wane eventually because of the WB and UPN and BET, and Blues Brothers 2000 was kind of made during the decline when entertainment was kind of becoming resegregated.
Well, I think it was actually – it had to be in it because, I mean, Cosby was dead by this time, right? I mean, I don't know how long it was on, but Cosby's popularity didn't last past 90, right?
Right. Like Cosby had been off the air for a while.
Yeah, in terms of universal popularity, it didn't last past 90. I think it started in around 85, and it lasted a few years. And, I mean, a little aside, the problem with that was not that white people all of a sudden – started hating black people or something. It's the Cosby Show got really stupid with that little kid. But anyway, when they brought on the cousin from the Brady Bunch or whatever her name was. So you actually have a scene at the beginning of this where they acknowledge race for the first time in the Blues Brothers franchise where Joe Morton goes, well, excuse me, don't you you're my brother? Don't you understand? Don't you recognize that I'm African-American?
Yeah.
And Dan Aykroyd's comment is, I don't mind. And this doesn't fit with the first one. It doesn't fit. Well, it doesn't fit with the first one for a lot of reasons, because, I mean, Cap Calloway was an older gentleman in the first one. It's not really conceivable that he was cavorting around. Joe Morton's not old, but anyway,
yeah.
Joe Morton was part of, you know, the Terminator franchise. That James Cameron actually thought about this shit, as opposed to John Landis. It makes it weird bringing race into it to the degree this one does. It makes it almost uncomfortable because you've got Dan Aykroyd and, to a lesser extent, John Goodman, because John Goodman never comments on it. John Goodman actually plays this one a little bit like a very deferential sidekick. Very deferential.
Phoning it in, I think, is the phrase to use here.
John Goodman was very big into blues in New Orleans. He's on Tremé now and things like that. And I think he really wanted to separate himself from Roseanne or whatever. But damn, John Goodman, they couldn't have paid you that well. They filmed in Canada. But yeah, it's just the race thing is very strange in this one. And some of that, well,
I think... They have a lot less black guest musicians than they... I mean, did the first Blues Brothers even have non-black guest musicians?
No,
I don't
think
so.
Clapton,
but then here you've got, you know, Blues
here.
Traveler and and that one skinny white guy.
he could actually sing, though. I think he was a lot better than John Popper. I was surprised by him. But no, I mean, Eric Clapton shows up at the end.
And Paul Schaefer.
Paul Schaefer does the music for this. Yeah, let's – okay, we're
– But also away. Just by having – I mean, just by having two white blues brothers to join – I mean, in the first movie, okay, this might be a little too obvious to point out, but Jake and Elwood are supposed to be blood brothers.
Right. And in this one,
who happened to play blues, hence the Blues Brothers. In this one, like, Dan Aykroyd is just deputizing new Blues Brothers left and right. And the first two are big fat white John Goodman and stupid little white kid before Joe Morton, you know, is magically transformed into one.
He's magically transformed into a white blues musician is what he's magically transformed.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, so you watch the first one, and there are some good shots. I love the opening. There's not a single good shot in this freaking movie.
No.
John Landis is, and I don't know what his last, I don't think we've ever, I'm sure we've talked about this before, but sort of not. Well, Franklin and Bash, of course. You know, John Landis was coming off The Stupids.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think I haven't seen Innocent Blood in a while. I need to see it again. But John Landis was not at the high point of his career here. He was at a low point. He was post-Stupids, starring Tom Arnold.
Remember the posters for that and how funny they were? Tom Arnold is stupid.
That was really funny. Yeah.
That poster is a lot funnier than Blues Brothers 2000, the movie.
The Stupids is a lot funnier than the Blues Brothers 2000, because I think, like, there's a scene where Tom Arnold accidentally sprays somebody with water. Well, that's the other thing about this movie. There are no jokes. There are no comedy sequences. The first one, yes, the scene in the restaurant sucked with Belushi and Aykroyd, and it was just lame. But the guy who was mortified that they were there, he was funny.
Yeah.
They don't have anything like this in here. Anytime there's a moment for that, they bring in the Russian mob who runs around like fat Terminators. I mean,
I know, and it's like they're making fun of the Russian mob in 1998. I mean. Geez, it's bad. It's bad enough when an action movie has like the Russians as the villains after the Cold War was over, but for a comedy, it's even lamer.
Yeah.
Also, you know, I was making fun of Landis's reliance on explosions and car chases in lieu of ideas. There's a lot of that in Blues Brothers, but because Blues Brothers 2000 probably wasn't made for nearly as much money or with as much goodwill, it's not so much a reliance on car chases as a reliance on bad special effects. Because we mentioned Miles Dyson flying up through the church revival tent.
He flies up through a vagina. Okay.
I hadn't quite read that into
really?
It. But
I mean, it looked like an angelic vagina.
I did notice that Joe Morton has to like move his arm to go up through the tent fold properly because they didn't prepare that well enough in time. But no, besides that, and besides the bad special effect of them turning into green black-faced zombies to play Caribbean music, there's also an incredibly silly scene where they're playing Riders on the Storm and stop motion or puppet skeleton cowboys appear in the sky.
Okay, so that's when they're remaking the scene of the first one when they play the redneck bar is that they're stuck at a bluegrass festival. And apparently nobody told John Landis that in 1998 people who liked bluegrass music were yuppies. Or proto hipsters, but whatever. Yeah, it's this
it's
scene.
Really,
it almost makes you. Blues Brothers 2000 is a little bit like Superman Returns, where they thought they just had to remake the first one. And
yeah.
They'd be okay, but they don't remake it well enough to be okay.
Yeah.
If you don't follow the beats right, you're not going to end up in the same place.
It's also got a touch of the Airplane 2 syndrome, where they just repeat jokes verbatim from the first movie and expect them to be even funnier this time around.
We haven't talked about Dan Aykroyd.
Like, hey, my watch stopped, or my watch broke, because that was a running gag in the first movie that people's watches kept breaking after the car chases.
When Dan Aykroyd shows up in this movie, I think it's when he has his first couple lines with the kid.
Yeah.
Who he apparently runs off with the end. And if they make a Blues Brothers 3000, which is a really pervy, like, gay romance, I'll love it. I will. I'll love
yeah.
it. But anyway, he seems to, like, be doing not his terrible Chicago accent, which he drops at some point in this one. He seems to be doing, like, a Russian accent. And it's only for a couple lines, but I'm like... Didn't anybody tell Dan Aykroyd? And I think that's some of the problem with these is that, you know, John Landis has made good movies. Dan Aykroyd has been good in some good movies. Not just Ghostbusters. Dan Aykroyd was endearing and funny in Sneakers, which was not a comedy post
Yeah, even in Dragnet, he's
right.
He works
yeah,
well.
Yeah, he works fine in Dragnet. That had nothing to do with Saturday Night Live. So clearly, he can take direction. Clearly, he can do this and other things. It's like John Landis doesn't tell him what to do. And so he just lets him do whatever stupid thing he wants to. And I think one of the funnier parts of this one is that in the that his in the first one, Elwood's trying to pick up on Twiggy, right?
Right.
I've never seen a more desexualized character than Dan Aykroyd's in this one, except Alan Rickman from Dogma. Without the freaking commentary. I mean, it's so, it's like a cartoon. It's really yeah. like a cartoon how desexualized all of the characters are, considering they're, you know, in a strip club.
Well, but it's sort of, but I mean, I said that the first Blues Brothers was meant to be a kid's movie in a way. I feel like Blues Brothers 2000 is for like, I don't know, somebody for like a dad who just showed his 8-year-old the Blues Brothers 1 and the 8-year-old loved it. And hey, Blues Brothers 2000 is coming out this week because that it's even because you've got a little kid and because you've got, you know, silly special effects and it's all even more so. But then, oh, hey, there's something for the dads, too. They go to a strip
yeah.
club.
yeah. There's nothing good to say about this movie.
No, this is probably I can't say it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen, but I think it's one of the worst Hollywood comedies I've ever seen.
I mean, for us, for announcement
and
podcast,
and for us, and we've watched a lot of bad movies. On
I mean,
this podcast.
Galaxina was a lot more. Oh, holy shit! Bewitched was better than this. I'm gonna go with that.
Yeah. I'd have to agree, yeah. And that was just a couple episodes ago.
On the other hand, The Rage Carry 2, well, yeah, maybe.
I'm also gonna say better than
that was
Blues
so
Brothers
much shorter than Blues Brothers 2000. Because you've got to remember, Blues Brothers 2000 is 2 hours and 4 minutes long. Yes, yeah. It does have 7-minute end credits, but still.
It's almost as long as the first one. Well,
yeah, I'm really gonna have to look back. I'm looking through our archives here, and I'm gonna say that this is the worst movie we've watched since. Oh God, I'd rather watch Cool World. Sextet.
I could watch Cool World any day of the week. It's so
Sextet.
So
is it
awful?
Are we gonna go with that? It's worse than Sextet.
Yeah, it is worse than Sextet because, you know. Timothy Dalton singing Love Will Keep Us Together entertains me more than any of the musical performances in this one.
Yeah. And a little bit about that is that they did actually have a cameo from somebody. B.B. King, he shows up at the end as part of the Super Blues Band, which also includes
Isaac Hayes.
Isaac Hayes for a second.
Eric Clapton.
And Eric Clapton and some other people. Clarence Clemens didn't really get a big shot, I don't feel like. But B.B. King doesn't have an opening number. He doesn't get the music video treatment like in the first one. It's like, did they... Oh, God, Steve Winwood was in their super band? Jesus Christ. okay, so that's how we've gone. We've gone from James Brown having a musical number in the first one to freaking Steve Winwood being in the super band. But yeah, B.B. King doesn't get it. He's the junkyard owner. He doesn't get his own musical number. And it's like, did they cut it or did they just not film it? Because they thought, you know, they didn't need to. I don't know. But I do want to bitch a little bit about Paul Schaefer.
He's extremely annoying.
Well, he's extremely annoying in this movie because he's dressed up like Amadeus first.
Right,
then,
and he's doing this outrageous accent.
It's like Bronson Pinchot couldn't do the jazz score or the blues score. But yeah, he also does the music. So Blues Brothers 2000 score is, you know, blues via... He does Letterman show, right? It's blues yeah. via late night TV band. I mean... It's worse than the extra and intro music on Saturday Night Live with that guy.
Yeah, that has more soul to it.
Yeah,
Don Pardo reads off the names.
It's just fucking awful.
Yeah, Yeah. Yeah.
Major theatrical release, though, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, no, because I remember when this thing came out, and even as you know, like, as a teenager, thinking, wow, really? Like, Blues Brothers 1 was a long time ago, and John Belushi's been dead for at least, you know, almost as long as that, and they're just going to replace him with another fat white guy, John Goodman? Like, they really think that's going to work? I guess that's the thing about a movie like this, is that you really have, like, how deluded do the makers have to be not to think that they're going to come up with a good movie, but to think that like it's that it's going to be any kind of a success?
It opened at 2,500 theaters. That's pretty big.
I know.
It didn't make its money back, which is of course shocking. But you know, now I don't know what started, you know, all the discussions of box office, but since this era, there's been a lot of discussion of it. People talk about how big the release is. People talk about, and it's just gotten bigger with the internet. And Blues Brothers 2000 was 98, so it was sort of web 0.5. But you know, somebody must have noticed that releasing a 130-minute movie into the theaters and hoping to get multiple plays a day doesn't help. And holy shit, there is a fucking Blu-ray. There is a Blu-ray. You can get it for $15 from Amazon. Oh my God.
Oh, that's good.
Good. You can't get the Magnificent Ambersons on Blu-ray. And, hold on, it came out a month ago, so I guess we're just tying into the Blu-ray.
We're helping sell it. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it seems a lot like a movie, which I think in the late 90s was kind of the first time that people started seriously talking about Ghostbusters 3 again. And this is like the movie that Dan Aykroyd probably thought would help generate interest for Blues Brothers 3 again. Like, you know, hey, let's revisit more beloved 80s characters with SNL alumni in them. Didn't quite pan out that way, though.
No. Dan Aykroyd, of course. Let's see here. What's he been doing lately? What's funny is he came off of Gross Point Blank, which sort of... Well, he did Feeling Minnesota, which was supposed to be his big branching out. And then he did Gross Point Blank, which was more successful. And then he really did some weird shit. He did House of Mirth, which I haven't seen. Ivan Reitman threw some pity on him. Woody Allen, he was good in Jade Scorpion.
I noticed that he hasn't. He's acted in stuff. He's never tried writing anything since Blues Brothers 2000.
Well, I mean, how do you top this?
Ghostbusters video game, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, how do you freaking top this? Well, he also wrote Coneheads. I guess he was just in the campaign. He was in Yogi Bear.
Right.
I mean. It's, you know, the guy sits around and he tries to think of stuff he can do based on movies other people made popular that he happened to have a controlling interest in.
That's brutally accurate.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that's all that needs to be said about Blues Brothers 2000, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Then I think we've
exhausted.
Acquitted ourselves on the Blues Brothers, and our next episode is going to be Godzilla. We're going to be watching the original Godzilla, not the original Japanese one, which I have seen, but the Americanized Raymond Burr version. Which I haven't seen, but which should still be pretty good. And then we're going to, well, speaking of the late 90s, a rather infamous bomb. And really, 1997 was kind of, I think, the year that Hollywood broke the heart of the summer blockbuster between this and Batman and Robin. But, oh, wait, no, Godzilla was 98, wasn't it? Not 97.
Was it? Yes, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, but what's the difference of a year? Anyways, yeah, it's Roland Emmerich's Godzilla.
With
Ferris Bueller, speaking of Chicago, and a bunch of crappy post-Jurassic Park CG Raptor-esque Godzilla babies and all this stuff. And I know all this without even having seen it. That's how infamous it was.
You've never seen it?
No.
Oh, shit, you're in for a joy. It's 2 hours and 24 minutes, for God's sake.
Holy God. Well, at least I watched Blues Brothers 2000 first, so maybe Godzilla will come off a little better.
And so I think it probably will, which is scary because it's not good. And one of the things that we wanted to do this time is if you have any remarks about those movies that you would want comment on, and I don't really know how to describe that, but with Blues Brothers and Blues Brothers 2000, we both noticed a lot of people had feedback on the idea of watching
preemptively chiding us for saying that we weren't enjoying watching the original.
Right. If you want to chide us or whatever for not liking Roland Emmerich and whatever.
Probably the best thing to do would be to go to the Stop Buttons Facebook page, which should just be like facebook.com/stop the stop button, right?
I think it's facebook.com/stop button, but you just comment on anywhere on our on AlanSmithyPodcast.com because
that works
we
too.
See that too.
Let us know what you think. Let us know your precious memories of seeing Godzilla in the summer of 2007.
Things we should remember.
97, 98, whatever it was. Yeah, we want to hear that stuff.
Things we should remember while we're wondering whether or not Matthew Broderick finds Godzilla scarier than Sarah Jessica Parker when she doesn't get her latte.
Heyo. All right. Okay,
that joke was so bad Dan Aykroyd could have written it.
Yeah. Alright, so for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
Thanks for listening.